Let's make sure that history never forgets the name.
Sci-Fi Malady.
Got out.
This is it. The command center.
You sure?
We've cleared just about every deck. This has got to be it.
Time to make these aliens pay.
Pay for all the crappy films.
Pay for boredom.
Pay for Prodigy. Guns up, guys.
Let's hope whoever it is, they didn't have a pet xenomorph.
Avoid the acid blood if they do.
On three. One, two, three.
Arrgh!
Show yourself and eat lead.
Welcome, gentlemen. You finally found the source of your abductions, it seems.
Rock?
Thomas, so nice to see you again, my friend.
Wait. Cut the sirens, cut music or whatever we got. Cut it. You mean to tell us you've been behind our kidnappings this whole month?
Devilishly clever, don't you think?
Not really. You made us watch Progeny.
I can't drink enough bleach.
Ah, yes. That was regrettable, but I had to find a way to incur your wrath so that you would find me.
But why? Why not just send a PM on Discord?
Because what's the fun in that? I wanted to test your limits, push the boundaries of what you could stand. I also just really wanted to be on the show again.
Again, a message would have been just fine.
I see you don't understand the joy of my plan. Oh, well. No matter. Have a seat, gentlemen, and we shall review a movie.
You think after all that, we will review a movie with you?
Where else will you go now that you are trapped in my vessel? Besides, Rage requires a fourth and final episode for the month.
He's got a point there.
Fine.
But I do have one final request.
What more can you do to us?
I just want to be the one to answer Thomas's question this week.
Whatever. Thomas, lead us off.
Fine. So, Ruck, what are we watching this week?
We are watching a Blumhouse horror sci-fi abduction story called Dark Skies.
Really? Sci-Fi Malady, Symptom 192. Dark Skies. It doesn't really work. They're pinky, and the brain.
Oh! Brain. Welcome back, sickies, to the final episode of Alien Abduction April. And we are wonderfully rejoined by our number two time Ruck, guest Ruck from the over at Cosmic Anomaly Productions. Ruck, take a bow.
Aloha, everyone.
Bond villain today.
I was going to say, he plays a wonderful Bond villain, if anybody's looking to hire that voice actor. So, actually, Ruck, I have to say, you exceeded my expectation there. I was really, I wasn't sure how you were going to do it, but it was better than I could have imagined. So, thanks for that.
I was hoping to almost do like a adverse effect on it. I was really hoping to give it the high-pitched voice, but you told me no, so.
No, I needed, we were going for more of a, like I said, a Bond villain who wanted to be on the show, but for some God knows reason wanted to torture us because Bond reasons. Bond villain reason. Good enough.
Let's be honest, Mark, you're just trying to take the blame off of yourself.
Again, once again, yes. So today we are going to finish off with the film from 2013, Dark Skies, which is a Blumhouse production. And I'm the first thing I thought when I saw this film was they had the introduction with Blumhouse, and Blumhouse is most famous for a lot of jump scare films, horror films like, The Conjuring. And Insidious, that's a good one. They also have the Annabelle doll and those are actually pretty good movies. I do like Insidious quite a bit. But when I saw that, what was going through my mind was, all right, well, they're going to stick their foot in something different. Okay, let's give it a shot. I mean, horror and sci-fi could work, so let's see what they do. And I'll say this. I didn't dislike the movie, honestly. I was able to pay attention the whole time. I enjoyed it. But the whole time I kept thinking, well, not the whole time, but as it carried on, I started thinking, I don't know if this really works. Thomas, you kind of put it best early on before the show when you said it looks like they took the skeleton and guts of a horror movie and then flipped it to Alien.
Pretty much. It looks like they filmed an entire movie about like Slender Man or something and then just went, oh, let's change genres or something. Marketing says aliens are popular this year.
Yeah, exactly. And that doesn't make it bad. It just, for me anyway, and, you know, Ruck and Scott, you could say what you put your piece in here for a minute, but I kind of felt like, yeah, this is entertaining, but it just doesn't fit very well. It's like, I'm going to go eat tacos, but in that taco, I'm going to put feta cheese and stuff you would put in a Greek salad. It's like, it might taste good, but it just seems off.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the right analogy because, like, you can put just about anything in a flour tortilla and it's probably going to be okay.
Well, but you're okay. You're taking the traditional ingredients of the taco and then shoving, like, olives, olive oil, feta cheese, and Greek yogurt onto it. It's like,
hey, don't knock it until you try it.
Yeah. As a Mexican, I'm going to have to disagree with you on that one, Scott. not everything tastes good in a tortilla, unfortunately.
Right.
It might taste good.
I might enjoy it well enough, but I just the whole time I'm going to be like, this is these are things that should not go together.
I don't know. I mean, like I guess what I'm saying is the wrap has become pretty universal. Like, I mean, almost everything. I mean, McDonald's was serving Big Mac wraps.
Right, but I'm just okay. Not so we don't get into the divulge into a food discussion about what fits and doesn't fit. It was just a corollary. It was just an analogy to say, good but doesn't fit. That's all I was trying to say. If you prefer, let me use one that Scott can argue: the German chocolate cake with coconut on it. Germans don't use coconut on their traditional cakes. You might like the cake, but it ain't German. That's better for you.
You got to use some sauerkraut in that.
Look, I really can't argue the first one either. I just argue to argue.
I know you're just being devil's advocate because that's what you are. What did you think, Scott? I know.
I thought this was an entertaining film. I'll go deeper into my opinion on it as we go along, but maybe it's just due to the low quality of stuff we've been watching this month, aside from Fire in the Sky. But I found this film. Okay.
Yeah, so did I.
That's a ringing endorsement, considering that we did a whole 42 minutes on Progeny saying, do not watch this film.
And you know what? I reiterate that until my dying breath. Do not watch that film. If somehow, some way, Progeny comes across your feed, swipe left, close the browser, whatever you got to do, just don't watch that film.
I just like that we have Mark's revisionist history in this week's intro, that it is Ruck's fault that we watched Progeny. Like, he takes of this, it is 100% his blame, puts it on Ruck. Donald Trump approves with your rewriting of history.
There's an explanation for that, Scott. You see, what happened was, without me knowing it, Ruck used a ray machine of some kind to take control of me so that I would make those decisions. So
yeah, I used the ray from Turkish Superman that turns everything into gold. I just repurposed it into a mind control device.
Yeah, exactly. And so I really wasn't myself at the time.
Do we find that in the same store that has Kellyanne Conway's microwave that transforms into a TV?
Yeah.
Yep.
Boy, I'm getting way too political. I'm going to scare off half the listeners.
But the point is, yes, that's what happened.
That Mark's behind it, not Ruck.
It's a conspiracy.
Which one's correct?
Yeah.
You decide. So a little bit of fun facts and plot here before we jump in, because the fun facts aren't really that many, but one of them is that Carrie Russell was actually the first and only choice for the female lead. And the only reason she was attracted to the project was because of its depiction of a mother fighting for her family, because she doesn't really like science fiction genre films, or genre films for that matter at all. So,
what were they going to do if they could get her? What were they going to do if they couldn't get Carrie Russell? Were they just be like, I guess we can't make the film. Scrap everything. Fire everybody.
You know what? That would be funny.
I will say the budget was only $3.5 million. So that probably was an option all the way up until the moment the post-production was finished.
Yeah.
So the original pitch for the film was, and I am not even surprised I saw this, and I'm going to tie it back to something you said pre-show there, Rock. The film was originally pitched as a found footage film, which is exactly what I was thinking. And then, Rock, you said something earlier before we started recording about the Blair Witch Project. Why don't you share with the stickies what you were saying there?
This movie, I feel like it takes from a lot of other different better movies. And I think obviously, because this is made by Blumhouse, I feel like they kind of have a right to take from Paranormal Activity, because I did feel a little bit of that as well.
For sure.
I completely forgot that Blumhouse made Paranormal Activity until you were starting to list off some stuff. I was like, wait, they made that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then as well as the scene where the father, Daniel, where he is outside just chilling out, mouth open, making a weird noise. It just reminded me of the Blair Witch, like at the end, when dude standing in the corner, and then obviously the movie just ends after that, but just reminded me a lot of that. And I was like, what the heck? And then obviously, I said something else, didn't I? Yeah. At the end, that last scene really reminded me of Signs, where they're sitting at the table and everything's boarded up, and it just feels like almost like a mix of what Thomas said and what I said, where they filled the skeleton of a ghost movie with an alien, as well as they just stole from a whole bunch of really successful ghost and alien movies. And they're like, let's just make a montage of all the best moments from everything. And it's going to be pretty mediocre.
Well, it's funny you say kind of mishmashing stuff before, because the final fun fact I'm going to mention is that there is an actual tribute to Close Encounters of the Third Kind when Daniel and Carrie Russell's character, Lacey, the mom, they meet Edwin Pollard, who is most famous for being J. Jonah Jameson and his...
Oh, J.K. Simmons.
Yeah, J.K. Simmons. When he laughed, that guy, he's a UFO expert. And they go to see him to see what's going on in their house. And he's supposed to be like the Claude Lacombe character from the movie Close Encounter of the Third Kind, the Frenchman that was looking for the aliens. No. And so the Q&A test comes kind of as a tribute to that. So, yeah, very much. And stuff being derivative is not necessarily bad. Everything's derivative at the end of the day. But when you can start to see the mishmash, like, okay, a little bit of Blair Witch, a little bit of Paranormal Activity and this and that, like I said, Blumhouse is really good at their jump scare supernatural horror stuff, and when they try to veer into other things, it's almost like they don't know how to change gears very well, so they just use a heavy dose of what they know. And does that make it bad? No, but it makes it a little bit, for me anyway, out of place.
I was pretty surprised that Ed and Lorraine Warren didn't show up in this film.
Well, what were they going to put in their room? You know, what were they going to put in their, what is that room where they have a special name for it, where they secure all the old objects, the haunted objects?
They do. It's in Connecticut, and I've visited it before, but I don't remember the name of the room.
Yeah, okay, because I know that's there, and I know the Annabelle doll looks like a regular old Raggedy Ann doll, but... Yeah. They let people go in there, huh?
Yeah, they do tours. I think they do, like, they allow you to, like, look through a glass at it, but you can't, like, go in the room.
Oh, okay, okay.
So, at least from what I remember, I was, like, 7 or 8 when I went there.
Oh, okay. But, yeah, so... And in fact, I'm going to really quick, and I guarantee you guys, I'm going to be able to do this in a minute because I'm just reading from a script here. The plot, just to give you sickies the idea of what this is, the Barrett family, Lacey and Daniel, the parents, their older son, Jesse, and younger son, Sammy, live in this nice, quiet suburb. And Daniel is currently unemployed, and Lacey is having to do a lot of the work as a real estate agent. Their two sons they get along pretty well. They have a nice life. And the son has this weird friend that's trying to teach him about sex, I guess.
Oh, rat face.
But yeah, rat face. That's it. But they also communicate that the two sons have a good relationship. They talk to each other through walkie talkies when they go to sleep at night. And it's kind of a cute little scene. But what starts happening was these strange occurrences start happening with the family during the night. Kitchens are rearranged in bizarre configurations. House alarm goes off, detects entry points. Sammy suffers a fit while playing soccer. Like, he starts screaming. Or no, it's not screaming. I'm thinking, yeah, it was screaming, right?
Well, he was silent at first.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, then all of a sudden, like, hundreds of birds crash into the house suddenly. And then one night, Lacey is awakened by a sound from Sammy's room. She goes to check on him. Through the darkness, she sees a figure standing over the bed, you know. And as things go on, the kid starts calling him Sandman, or Gray Man. And it turns out that it's actually an alien who is coming after, I just said his name, Daniel Jesse. And he's been visiting Jesse. They've been visiting Jesse his whole life. Like, he had health problems as a kid, and now he's fine. But they abduct him in the end. And then the family winds up living in this, like, apartment trying to get their kid. And they wind up missing. And it ends with J. Jonah Jameson writing their names on a list of disappeared people. So, yeah. So that's kind of, and then Lacey, Daniel, and Jesse, they actually suffer a memory loss of what happened. So it's very much, and as far as, like I said, if you're thinking, oh, well, the kid got beamed aboard a ship, right? Well, hypothetically, he did. We don't actually see it. So we don't actually, like, the aliens themselves, unlike Communion, where... Yeah, those aliens were interesting. You don't really see them too much in this movie.
I thought that was a good thing, though. I'm glad that they didn't show us the full alien, because I think that would have taken me out of the scare factor a little bit.
Well, yeah, they were going for horror, and the unknown is scary, so...
This movie actually did, like, I'll say twice, the jump scares got me and actually gave me chills. And I actually think the ending where you hear the older brother screaming through the radio that he used to communicate to his younger brother was a chilling way to end that as well. And also, like, you hear the dad saying, well, you're our lawyer. Can't you at least pretend like you believe us?
Right.
Yeah.
And that kind of cuts to the next point I want to go into.
Oh, and you went well over a minute.
Yeah, I'm sure I did.
I've been looking at my timer. I'm like, man.
I always lie. That's my other time. I lie about my plot summaries. I suck.
Listen, back in the early days, the plot summaries became the entire show, and we did the show around the 57-minute plot summary. So this is much improved.
Yeah, well, Ellie, I didn't do that all the time. You know, we're not going to go over what Rage Master has done wrong.
Oh, look, we can go over. I mean, look, I've done a whole ton of terrible things throughout the history of this show, too. So
is this about to be a new Scott rant?
No.
What Rage Master does wrong.
That's going to be a quick rant. But go ahead, do a quick rant for it. I'll be interested in your script. So I'll add to it for you. I think this is a big point I want to jump on before we do any rips and picks. So we keep hammering home that this is a horror sci-fi film, heavy in the horror. It looks like they tried to make a horror movie and then were last minute switched a few things to make it sci-fi.
Horror.
So horror, yes, horror. Sci-fi. Yeah, we got to stress that. Horror sci-fi.
This isn't the movie you find on the internet. Don't worry.
No. Does in this, particularly in the style of a Blumhouse jump scare, does it work? Or does horror sci-fi work in general? And I would say it can, depending, because the greatest example is Alien. Yeah, but
I was just about to say Alien.
But in general, beyond that, can it work? So I'm going to leave that open on the floor there. Can horror and sci-fi, if this were a Venn diagram, where's the middle?
Well, I sure hope so, because we do a month every single year in October about it.
True, true. And we have been doing it. But that's why I'm going to specify it in more of the Blumhouse style jump scare, supernatural, maybe even. So what do you think? Because something like Event Horizon, clearly that's horror sci-fi.
Yeah.
And it's a really good one.
And it works. I wish we could see the movie that didn't get made with the 30 minutes of lost footage.
Oh, yeah. I think it can work. But I think you have to have like a very specific recipe. Because I feel like a lot of what the horror movie with sci-fi does is it's just alien comes to Earth and tries to abduct someone. Oh, no, scary alien. It's either that type of film or like basically an alien ripoff where we have to go into space and there's an alien on the ship and we're trapped in here with them.
Yeah. And it's a slasher villain at that point.
Yeah. That's what I was about to say. You've got to avoid making it Jason in space, which was a very entertaining movie, but it can't become the alien is, I mean, if I can replace the alien with Jason Voorhees or Freddy Krueger, it's probably going to be something that would have been better off as a slasher movie. There are specific stories that you can tell with horror sci-fi that fit very well. Right now I'm watching Night Flyer, and that was made in 2018. I think only got one season, and it's based off a George R. R. Martin novella. But that one is focusing around psychic humans who become violent and try to kill other humans all the time. And aliens that have more in common with the psychic humans than they do actual humans. So when you get into these mind-bending, like, psionic examples, that can fit well into horror sci-fi. When you're talking about, like, hell dimensions work well. I mean, that Event Horizon is basically about the ship going into an alternate dimension and going to hell and coming back and bringing hell back with it. Those type of things were great. For horror sci-fi, Jason in space. I mean, we love it for the kitsch.
Yeah.
You've got to know what you want to do. And like with anything, I mean, you can come up with any genre and say, can it work? Any story, a love story, a romantic comedy only works if you know from the start that you're going to be a romantic comedy and stay in that lane rather than being a romantic drama. If you don't know if you want to be a romantic comedy or a drama, then you're going to have a terrible result. If you don't know if you want to be a suspense film or a horror film or a drama, and you start mixing and matching, you're going to have a horrible result. But when you know what you want to be from the start, then you have a good chance of success. I think a lot of times, Mark, you could be right, like with this film, that these sci-fi horror films are horror movies that didn't make it and didn't get greenlit, and they try to convert an existing big bad, so to speak, into an alien or into a science fiction movie. The only thing that seems to be more common is to convert a failed movie into a Die Hard movie. But I mean, that's why every Die Hard after the first one just got worse and worse and worse all the way through, because only one of them, until you got the Die Hard 6, somehow Bruce Willis is still an action figure or action hero. was not meant to be a Die Hard. Anytime that you start taking a movie, I mean, look, if you watch Die Hard 3, you can clearly see that it was supposed to be Lethal Weapon. And
Die Hard 25, Die Hard in Space.
Right, right.
Bruce Willis is dying harder.
Michael Bay. This summer, Michael Bay remakes the original Die Hard. Now with more explosions. And Bruce Willis is replaced by a fighting robot that transforms into a car.
And you would go see it, Scott.
Yeah, but no, I, in a long-winded old man Grandpa Simpson way, yes, sci-fi horror can work if you just stay focused on what you're trying to do, which and the story you're trying to tell, which I just failed at miserably because somehow I started out on that and got to Michael Bay remaking Die Hard.
No, you brought it back around. You're just like the flight that had to not land, had to take off and then land again.
Ooh, shiny ball. Ooh, what's that? Ooh, shiny ball. Ooh, what's
that? Well, you said Die Hard, so you immediately were like, ooh, Nakatomi Plaza.
I definitely have shiny ball syndrome. Ooh, what's that?
Shiny ball syndrome. I think you get that when you're really old, Scott.
Ooh, what's that?
Yeah. So what about you, Ruck and Thomas? The same thing. Can this work, particularly the Blumhouse style of horror?
If we're going like found footage Blumhouse style, kind of like Paranormal Activity, I think it's a bit hard to do that. And I think they almost did it to the extent of what they could in this film, where Daniel has the cameras set up and he has the security alarm set up so that it'll notify him if anything's coming in. And I think this will come into the fact later when we do rips and picks, but I really did like that creep factor where, oh, all the entrances were breached at the same time, but none of them were tampered with. And like that's what sci-fi horror should be. It's like, how is that possible? And obviously with the aliens and stuff, it's like, oh, okay. You kind of get it after a while. But I think they almost did the adverse effect of what Scott was saying in this film, where they were like, we're going to make this a alien sci-fi horror film. And then they were like, but we're going to do all the tropes of a ghost film.
Yeah.
And they became unfocused. So without reiterating Scott's point into the ground, I think, yeah, you can do it, but there's a good balance. And I think the perfect balance, like right in the middle, like the perfect example of a sci-fi horror is Alien.
I'll give you another one. Phantasm, the original Phantasm.
Oh yeah. Phantasm. Yeah.
Boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
Scott's partial to Phantasm.
It's not that it hasn't been done. It's a challenging thing to do. And if it's done properly, it's fantastic. But that's pretty much with everything, let's be honest.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. All right. So, yeah, so now we're going to start getting into it could work, but does it work here? So we're going to start with our rips and picks. And I always say let's start with rips and then do picks and then we screw it up. So let's just open the floor. A pick for me would be that the family actually was kind of smart in that they set up cameras and things like that. They just the problem I had with Paranormal Activity is that until towards the end of the film, the family is just so utterly stupid.
Yeah.
And in this one, they're not. They actually, of course, the father, Daniel's like, I'm not believing this is aliens. But what they also show, which really intrigued me, is the way the mother went down the rabbit hole. So she's trying to find out what's wrong with her son. So she goes online, God help her. And she starts seeing little videos or little websites or whatever about aliens and kidnappings. And she just keeps clicking and clicking and clicking and clicking. And this is a lot of how people in modern day get into conspiracy theorism. And I don't mean just something feasible, like politician X has some strange dealing with this person. I wonder what's up. And they just stop there and kind of say, well, maybe there's an investigation. Let's see if there is a collision, you know, collusion or something. No, I mean, we're getting down to, you know, Ruck, you mentioned lizards kidnapping Malaysia Flight 370, or despite the fact that Denver International Airport opened up their gates and let Jesse Ventura inspect every square inch of it. Nope, there's still something there. They're hiding it. And so people get caught in this downward spiral. And then unfortunately, like you look at something like social media or YouTube, they have an algorithm that feeds it. So it's okay. I see you're watching these movies or videos about the Denver airport or lizard people. Well, I'm just going to give you more. So, and that's what happens with her. Now, of course, it's a film, so it just happened to be true, but it depicts it really well. And I don't know if that was intentional or not, but I really did like that.
I do want to say really quickly, as a quick side note to that and that pick that you had, Keri Russell did absolutely fantastic in this movie.
Oh, she, yes. Yes.
Best part about this movie, besides J.K. Simmons, I would say. This family was actually pretty, I would say, believable. Mm-hmm. To me at least, because the parents, obviously, they get along, but they don't get along all the time. And at least for me, that's just like human emotions, obviously. And I think the writers did a good job with that, with just having a good balance of, okay, there's struggle, but obviously these two people do love each other. And it's mostly the outside struggles putting strain on their relationship instead of a fake, like, I guess, inside argument that they have together. And they treat their kids really well. I think the one line that really does sell it for me was when the youngest son, what is the youngest son's name?
Sammy.
When Sammy is first starting to show signs of like his alien abduction stuff, and that the Sandmen are getting to him, the mom suggests therapy, and right. The dad immediately, instead of going, yes, we can pay for therapy for our son, he goes, how are we going to pay for that?
Yeah.
Which is really believable to me, because I know for a lot of people, that's going to be the first thought, especially when you have that at the forefront of your mind of, how are we going to pay for that? We are currently struggling enough financially that the dad goes, we should probably stop watching cable for a while.
You're 90 days past due on your mortgage statement. Ruck, you read my mind. I was going to say, if you're looking for, you know, adding some verisimilitude, I mean, right there, that little argument does a lot to keep you believing in these characters, because, you know, she says, we got a friend who works in a sliding scale. First, you told him we're having money problems. Hey, your kid is freaking out and talking to things that aren't there. But that's a real reaction, to be upset for a second that the wife might have let other people know they're having money problems. And then, you know, what you said, and then the wife comes back with, this is our kid, not a cable bill.
Yeah.
I mean, that really, you can believe that's a very, they didn't overplay it, and they didn't use a contrivance. They went with something very, very simple, and by keeping it there, I don't want to say understating it, but it's kind of an understated little argument. It's enough to show you what the stress is doing to this family.
Yeah. You know, I to piggyback off that, that's, wow, that was a good lead. That was a good pickup from where I was saying, because the husband, too, you see him struggling to get a job. Yes. But then he gets the job, but by that point, he's in so deep that he can't function, and he loses the job right off the rip. And it's not because he's acting like a lunatic. It's because by that point, he's accepted the reality of the situation. But like you said, he fights it, and not just for a fiscal reason, but also I'm not indulging this. And unlike in other movies where you just find the unbelieving husband to be a blockhead, here it's like, no, I understand him completely why he doesn't believe it. If I found out that my wife was looking at conspiracy websites, and then she said, oh, well, that explains why I'm having headaches. I would not be inclined to follow. I wouldn't be inclined to go speak to this ex-alien expert either. So they paint it in a real good way, and it's not over the top acted with hyper emotion or anything like that.
Yeah, I could just see that. Mark, I want you to go see this expert I found about why I'm having headaches.
Oh, man, that would require marriage counseling.
In the ancient astronaut theory, it's possible that extraterrestrials are causing her headaches. I'm not saying it's aliens.
I would be
calling
up a marriage counselor because that would be a serious issue. I don't think I could. That would be. I wouldn't divorce her or anything, but it would be like, okay, we need to deal with this because I'm not going down this road.
Mrs. Rank,
and somehow
Master,
the therapist would still
expert?
Take her side.
Somehow.
Mrs. Ragemaster, who is this expert? I don't know, but he said we could pay him with 17 cans of hairspray. Oh, no, it's Gargio Suklis.
I thought you were going to go, and who is this? It's J.K. Simmons. Can I have his phone number real quick? I'd like to ask him a few questions.
Yeah.
About Spider-Man in particular.
Yeah. I was wondering if he could comment on how he laughs as J. Jonah Jameson. That's really, that was a really good meme. But another thing kind of bleeding into the reality of this situation is when they go see Edwin Pollard, the J.K. Simmons character, the alien expert, he doesn't immediately believe them. He's just open to questions. He's not Giorgio Tsoukalos, who's like, aliens, because you said aliens. He sits down and he's like, all right, let me get some questions here. Because it's kind of like Ed and Lorraine from the Conjuring movies. They look for the logical explanation first. And in fact, In the first Conjuring movie, they actually find out that the noise that people think is a ghost is just wood expanding and rubbing up against the heating vent. And they even tell them, they're like, most of the time it's a logical explanation.
That's my pick, is when they're talking to him. My favorite, my big pick of this movie is when he says, I don't know about the reptilians. I don't believe those reports are credible.
Yeah.
I don't know about the reptilians.
But he does that Q&A, things like, okay, well, do you see bright lights in the sky or neighborhood that move in an unusual way? Do you have migraines or headaches? Are there unexplained illnesses or allergies or nosebleeds all of the time? Do you have abnormal behavior in animals in the neighborhood, which goes along with the fact that they did hire actual veterinarians to do research to say these are different animals and we can't for the life of us understand why they would herd and attack your house.
Yeah, I actually had a really quick rip about that little scene as well, kind of piggybacking for the quiz that he was giving them. There was only like he had one or possibly two questions at the beginning that could possibly weed out some of the really crazy people, and then nothing else like to maybe throw them off after that. Because after those two questions, it was just all like,
I believe.
Like, yeah, this is the I believe kind of stuff, like the do you have headaches or migraines? Yes. Do you black out for certain amounts of time? Yes. Do you have animals doing weird stuff in your neighborhood? Yes. And there's like no like in between question where he's just like, do the aliens ever probe you in uncomfortable places? Like, just to like maybe see like, okay, maybe they're just saying yes because they can pick up on like contextual clues or something for these really kind of simple questions.
Well, if he had asked Christopher Walken that question, he would have been like, yeah.
Boys.
Can we talk about this?
I got some cocktail weenies. The aliens, they gave them to me. They told me to stick them in your butt. This is a terrible Christopher Walken impression.
Yeah. You know who can do Christopher Walken? Christopher Walken.
The cadence is, look, I'm telling you, I did some sports radio with a guy who did a dead on Christopher Walken. It was amazing. I wish I still had a way to get a hold of the dude.
It's all in the cadence. It really is.
It is. But, it's a cadence.
But yeah, that's my big rip from that scene. I did also have questions. Do people like, do conspiracy theorists really decorate their entire apartment with newspaper clippings? Or is that just like a trope?
To look like they're Charlie looking for Pepe Silvia.
Yeah. That's just another rip that I had really quick from that one scene. But I really did like J.K. Simmons in this movie. I thought it was really funny to see him in this movie, and I thought he gave a pretty good performance as well. Just kind of done old man with a mustache. That's all he has ever been.
Yeah. Well, and now, didn't he say something at some point where he also had interactions with the aliens?
Yeah, but he said he stopped fighting them.
Yeah.
And he moved to an apartment that doesn't allow dogs because the dogs sense them.
Yeah.
Walking.
Of course the dogs do, because dogs are better than cats.
And then he showed them like the little thing behind his ear, the like tracker, the whatever, the probe or whatever they have.
That's a rip. You can't get it out. Every single time I think I've got it, it burrows deeper into my body. Into your ear? Where's it burrowing deeper into there?
Well, you see, Scott, it's organic technology that the aliens built, and they learned that technology from Puma Punke.
Puma Punke.
A few of the things in this movie can be easily just like unraveled if you just ask one question about it, and it's like, oh well, we just kind of yada yada'd our way through it, honestly.
Yeah, like all 8 entry points were set off at the same time, which is really cool, except
there are only 3 aliens.
Right. So the aliens are, to throw the Star Trek reference, they're traveling at warp 10, so they're in all parts of the universe simultaneously at once to set off the 8 entry points. And
now they just project.
This is the other thing, man. The aliens, the Greys in this film are just dicks to be dicks. They're watching the family forever, and they're like, well, when they start doing this, they're about to take someone. And they just want to screw with you because they can. Like, there's no rhyme or reason for what they're doing, for taking all the photos or stacking up the food in like, random columns. And Officer Barberty, who's in here in the beginning of this film, I think it's your kids. I don't want to say this, but you think your kids might be mad at you because you're maybe fighting with your wife? Is it possible you're fighting with your wife and your kids hate you?
That cop was so funny because he felt like one of those cops that you would see in a specific website online where he just walked onto the wrong set and they were like, okay, here's a script. Man, this is the weirdest adult movie I've ever been a part of. Okay, if you really want me to, I mean... aliens? Okay. This is gonna be a weird scene, huh? I didn't care for him too much.
Hey, where are all the fluffers?
But you know, that would be a rip too, because what is the point of these aliens? I mean, yeah, it's nice that we don't see them, but when it's the example is just, well, like we just take animals and experiment on them. Yeah, okay, but why? I mean, are they doing anything? Are they? And then the older kid, Justin or whatever,
Jesse,
when he calls through the phone, it's like, I'm just suddenly thinking of Stranger Things and going, Will! And then he's trapped in the Upside Down. It's like, so did they take Jesse to the Upside Down? I mean, was this his one phone call?
Right.
Where they're like, well, before we do the vivisection, we let you have your one phone call since you're allowed to have that in your country. So here it is. But by the way, the connection might not be really good. E.T. takes the best signal in the galaxy.
Yeah. Jesse
bought the best 5G.
Jesse turned his Moonraker 6 beams and pointed them towards Earth for one communication.
Yeah, do you think that the aliens read him his rights? You have the all right. We're taking you in.
Intersected.
You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say or do can be probed back inside of you.
I mean, but even if you go with the lab rat theory, again, the aliens' behavior makes no sense. I mean, maybe there's a sadistic research scientist out there who screws with his lab rat before he finally kills it. But, I mean, I don't imagine that, like, people mess around with the lab rat's head just to goof around with it before they, you know, test this new product on it to see what happens. For some reason, the aliens are like, we're about done with these guys. Let's play a bunch of practical jokes and see how much we can screw up their entire life before we abduct their kid. And what's your idea for tonight over there?
I mean, there are sadistic people that would do something like that, but then it just turns into, so all these aliens are just jerks? Is that what this is? So, and to lend into malevolent spirit type thing, you know, in the Sam would say they're the Sandman. And in other countries where the concept of the Sandman doesn't exist, they translated Sandman as the ghost.
Yeah.
So it's almost like you're trying to say, like, okay, so yeah, it's a ghost.
You know what this felt like?
It's a malevolent spirit.
The whole time this is going on, I'm thinking like this is like an adaptation of a Neil Gaiman story.
Yeah.
No, yes. I mean, that's what it felt like. And you guys, Thomas and Rage, you guys brought this up in Ruck. I mean, this is clearly the behavior of the aliens is clearly something they couldn't write out from the initial script where this was not about aliens, but about some malevolent spirit. Because that type of, it's like a trickster god at some point. It's just screwing with you to screw with you. Kind of like, it behaves like Freddy Krueger in ways, where Freddy would mess with someone for a bit before he finally took him in the dream.
Yeah, but Freddy had a purpose. He like, he was doing it to get back at the parents.
Right.
So he at least had a discernible cause. I mean, come Jason Voorhees never spoke a word except in part 8 when he just says, "Mommy, don't let me drown." But otherwise, all he does is kill campers and anybody else who happens to be nearby. But it's because he has like malevolent, I'm going to get revenge against all humanity who made fun of me as a kid and I drowned and they didn't care. It's weak, but it's there. I can get it. With these aliens, it really is just, well, they could be experimenting on us or they could just be jerks. We really didn't get that far into the motivational part. So this was supposed to be a malevolent ghost, but we flipped it. So.
They behave like middle school bullies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're doing it just to do it. So
speaking of middle school bullies, this is a great transition. I have another pick real quick.
Go for it.
I freaking love Ratface. I do not love Ratface as a person, but I love him as a character because I knew kids growing up that who were exactly just like him. Who would try to get you to do stupid stuff, who would be super rude to you and mean to you just because you were a little younger than them. And I know that exact kid. And I felt so happy when Daniel, the dad, goes and tries to beat him up. I was so happy. I was like, this is exactly like what I wanted to happen to him. Obviously, Daniel gets his crap rocked out of him.
Yeah, I hated that part. I was like, Daniel, no, why are you getting beat down by that other guy?
Yeah. Is that the guy at the beginning, by the way, who was at the barbecue with them? I'm pretty sure it was. I'm not 100% sure.
Been. I don't remember.
I also really did like that pool scene where Sammy was being taken care of by Jesse's love interest's mom.
Yeah.
I really did like that scene because I feel like that's also how a real crowd would react to a whole bunch of bruises on a child.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Like, yeah. Is that kid okay?
and the reaction too of how like the love interest was texting him like we're basically ostracizing you.
Yeah.
You guys are messed up. I would say that's probably the strongest pick of this movie is that the sheer realism of everything creates, as Scott said, a verisimilitude where I can believe the setting, I can believe the characters, and even though there's these weird it's not enough to take me out of the movie. Moments. It's not like in, I don't know, Suicide Squad, where there's just slam on the brakes and make me go, wait, how, what?
Oh, yeah.
So, or I don't know if anybody, we're not going to get too far into it, but if anybody watched Falcon and Winter Soldier, where
you're just taking my headphones off. I'm taking my headphones off.
Where you're supposed to feel bad for the Flag Smashers, but then you see the things they do, or you see the fact of their plan is to get it done. This is our goal, and this is, we're going to get it done. And because you never see anything being done, you just see them talking about the cause. You're like, it just slams the brakes and causes you to ask questions instead of enjoy the story. None of that happens in this. So,
yeah. The scene at, like, I guess you could say, like, right in the middle of the movie where Ratface, Jesse, Jesse's love interest, and then that other girl, were all together in the house that the mom was trying to sell. I think that was the most unbelievable part of it to me, because one, that scene never gets followed up on, and I think it's only for character growth for Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
But the scene where he grabs the boob, because he saw it in the adult film at the beginning.
Right.
He grabs the boob and goes, "You've been a bad girl."
That's so awkward.
It's so awkward. And then she's like, "What the heck are you doing?" And then like 2 seconds later, she's like full on making out with him. It's like, what? This is unbelievable. But everything else in this movie is okay. And then Ratface is just running around the other girl like an airplane. Like, am I impressing you yet? Yeah, does this do anything for you? Hot step.
you sounded like Rusty Venture from the Venture Brothers there. Does this do anything for you? Hot stuff. Yellow.
But yeah, were kind of all the rips and picks for me.
I got a rip.
It almost added realism, though.
Yeah.
Mom is a terrible realtor, and I don't understand how she hasn't lost her job beforehand.
Okay, so Scott's dipping into his mortgage business guy, so this is going to be pretty good.
No, this isn't even a mortgage business guy. This is the guy who had 18 months of sales experience and knows that you never look at the customer and say, honestly, I think you could do better. Like, your husband doesn't have a job. You're 90 days past due on your mortgage. You don't know how you're going to pay for your kid's psychiatrist. And the husband is dead set on buying this house because of the comps and the value. And you look at the wife and say, you can do better. You need this sale. Well, you know how much you need this sale.
She's being Marge Simpson. So what she needs is Lionel Hutz to show up and say, there's the truth and the truth.
Look, she's being a good human being. She's being a terrible salesman. Yeah. Also, her line is just so bad. It's like, yeah, it needs a lot of work, but that's just really a chance for you to make it yours by spending $80,000 to make the house look like you want it to. It's a crap show, but spend some money.
She should, again, use the Lionel Hutz line, handyman's dream.
So I also have a problem with the typical Hollywood trope. Here we have what I can best describe as middle-level project manager out of a job and not-so-good realtor who managed to live in the typical Hollywood, like, $750,000 home that is decked out with amazing furniture, hardwood floors, granite countertops. Even unemployed, has the ability to go out and just buy a whole security system full of cameras. Hollywood seems to have no concept of how middle-class Americans actually live, because they never get it right. Either middle-class Americans somehow have a house and the possessions and the lifestyle that you need to make almost seven figures to have, or everybody is just dirt poor. They don't understand what the middle class really is. They have no concept of it.
That really reminds me of the shows on like HGTV where they go, my husband is a stay-at-home dad, and I milk almonds for a living. Our budget is $2.7 million.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because as soon as Scott was saying that, I was like, wow, I watch a lot of that with my wife. And some days we look at what their budget is. It's like, wait. So you're going to nitpick about that, but your budget is, why don't you just get a cheaper home and use that budget to pay for this repair?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like, oh, wait, I'm sorry. Then there wouldn't be a show. Excuse me. Proceed.
I'm an Uber driver and my husband is a bartender. And we're looking to rehab this 374-year-old castle up here in New England. It's one of a kind. It has 17 rooms, and our budget is $4.2 million. Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's about time to rate this thing. How many, what was it? What do we call a Sandman, Grayman?
I want to do it. How many rat faces?
How many rat faces? Sure.
How many rat faces or how many bad pornos?
Yeah. So, well, how many rat faces?
I'm going to give it a good solid 7 out of 10 rat faces. I liked the beginning of the movie. It felt creepy. And then once the aliens showed up, I was kind of taken out of it a little bit. I thought that the family and the environment was really believable, but in the end, I just don't think that this was supposed to be an alien movie. So 7 out of 10 rat faces for me.
I'm going to say the same thing, 6 or 7, because the family's believable. I was able to, at no point was I bored. The pacing was good. The length was good. Once you realize this is a lot more like a jump scare film than a sci-fi film, I started just getting taken out thinking, I don't know if this really works. But it was entertaining enough. So 6 or 7.
I'm going to give it, I'm going to give it 8.
Ooh.
Ooh. Thomas is the controversial one today.
I know. It doesn't work in many ways, but it does work in the ways I think is the most important. And the most important part of this is it's supposed to be a suspenseful horror film. For one, they really don't show you the creatures. Even when they show you, they don't really show you. Mm-hmm. They leave a lot of it to your imagination. And the parts they don't explain in some ways work towards that. They don't explain why. They don't explain what's, you know, what they're doing this for. They're just doing it. Mm-hmm. There's no escaping. There was definitely parts of this that are suspenseful and definitely give you a horror feel. This is definitely a film that you probably should watch at night in the dark for all the effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it does work.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Thomas. The film works. To answer that question that we've discussed over this entire podcast, the film works. Yes, I do believe that it was not intended to be an alien abduction film at the beginning and converted to it. I don't think that is evident immediately in your first viewing. I think towards the end of it, when you put it all together and you reflect back on it, it becomes more apparent, and it'll probably make any rewatches of this film not work. At no point was I bored. I like and believe the characters, and the aliens work enough for me. Even though they could be passed off as ghosts or demons, they also work as an alien to me, because it doesn't have to be a gray alien. It just has to be something that is unfamiliar to me and that I can't comprehend and can't understand, which should be the definition of alien if you really think about it. And I think that this film succeeds in the jump scares startling me and creeping me out and leaving me with a creepy feeling. I like the fact that we don't get the pat happy Hollywood ending. The family loses in every single way possible. They lost their son. They're probably going to jail. Their other son's probably going to end up in the state custody system because they're going to believe that they abused that child. And I mean, you don't get a happy ending in any possible way. You have ruined the lives of 4 people just because. I don't know why I like that, but you don't get the pat Hollywood ending that you're expecting. But the film also loses points. It gets a 7 out of 10 because at the same time, Ruck is right that it is a terribly derivative film. to the point of wanting to do a little M. Night Shyamalan-ing at the end of it. And it does seem like this wasn't an original idea, but how many other good ideas can we take and mash together and try to pass it off as our own original creation when it definitely isn't, which is what I think Burger King is doing with its entire menu now, trying to rip it off from McDonald's, but I digress.
Spicy nuggets.
Ultimately, I give this a 7 out of 10 because it is a good, derivative, unoriginal film, and it's enjoyable, and at no point did I think that this was that it was dragging. So, yeah, I'm with Ruck and Mark on this one.
Yeah, that I think that's overall, if you were to average it out, that puts it somewhere in a 7 or 8, which is good. I mean, considering I said at the beginning this doesn't work, clearly I would also say, though it doesn't work, it's not a waste of your time, Sickies, especially in light of the other things we watched this month. So
thanks, Mark.
Yep. Hey.
Or me.
Yep.
Ruck.
It's all Ruck's fault. I told you. Control Ray.
Yeah. But
with speaking of Ruck, I want to, before we close out here, kind of veer off into Ruck here. He's the head honcho of Cosmic Anomaly Productions, but he also is running another show. So that just is not too old, but I want to talk about those two. So let's go to the first one here for an update on the Crate audio drama. So there was a little bit of a lull in the action recently, but you had some good news about that, though.
Yep. We're currently picking back up production. Me and the two other big people who work on the project, we all had a few things happen to us in real life that we needed to just kind of take like a month off, and it was kind of very sudden. So it just felt like we completely dropped the project. We have not completely dropped the project. We've been talking basically that entire time. I've talked to both Phoenix and Halv, and we felt that now was probably the best time to almost come back and pick up production again, because we all kind of felt like, okay, I think we're starting to become ready again. Just with where we are at situationally in real life. So we're finally picking up production for episode 2. Hopefully we should have something. I don't want to get anybody's hopes up. I will say before July 4th, we will hopefully have something up for you guys for that.
Definitely looking forward to that, because that was the first episode is out, and I listened to it on the trip down to Orlando, and I loved it. It kept me engaged the whole time, and I'm looking forward to will there be a chance to attach art to that?
Oh, I do hope so. We currently have places that you can go if you want to do art for us. We have our Discord server, as well as you can email cosmicanomalyproductions@gmail.com. If you have listened to the episode and if you liked it and want to draw for it, you can email that, and we will happily take a look at anything that you either draw or send to us, because we love doing stuff like that and giving people opportunities and stuff like that.
Okay, very cool, very cool. So, and I wanted to also focus on your next project, which has been out, and that is a podcast as well,
yeah,
called Cold Case Chase. And I've just signed up and started listening, and I listened to Lizzie Borden and the more recent episode, which was about the Black Dahlia murder. Mm-hmm. And you've already completed season 1 just this week, in fact, right?
So I finished writing for season 1. The season 1 finale, which I won't spoil what it is, but should be coming out at the end of this month, being May. So at the end of this month, season 1 will be complete, and then season 2 picks back up at the end of June, I believe.
Okay. So what exactly is Cold Case Chase, and where do we find it?
So Cold Case Chase is a podcast that I do. It's a commentary on old cold cases, where I kind of go through all the old facts, as well as I do scenes for like little quotes or little areas where I feel that I can drive up the drama a little bit and almost make you feel like you are part of the times and part of that case. So you can maybe feel like, oh man, this is interesting. This is cool. And you can almost feel like you were there. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts on. You can find it on Apple Music, Spotify, Anchor. You can find it on Google Podcasts. Basically, anywhere that you do listen to podcasts, my podcast it will be there. So yes, you can check it out. We also have other shows on that podcast feed, such as Case Closed, which goes back over old serial killers and tells of their crimes and how they got caught. And we also have Cross Examination, where we answer questions from fans or alternate theories from fans who like to talk about stuff that I particularly don't agree with sometimes, with their theories on aliens and other conspiracy theories that I bring up and go, oh my goodness, this is going to be an interesting podcast.
Well, your Lizzie Borden Cross Examination was good.
Oh yes. I recently just started getting back into editing, like really, really back into it, like sound engineering and getting music done. And so I decided that the first big project for that would be the Lizzie Borden cross-examination, which I have listened to too many times at this point because I absolutely love listening to it.
Oh, I re-listened to it, in fact, because I liked the sound editing, the intro, the outro music, the transitions. I thought it was really well done. I enjoyed listening to it. And I should say here, too, the format, Sickies, is something I enjoy, especially like Black Dahlia. It's like a drama, but it's laying out the facts. So it's kind of like not just a, well, this happened, then in 1939, they discovered a body here. And no, it's more like the detectives going through it and laying out the facts, which I find a lot more engaging than it's almost kind of documentary drama style, which is it keeps you engaged a lot. And I've already pitched this one, Torso Murders, Torso Murders, Torso Murders, cover the torso murders for us in here in Cleveland.
But, oh, yeah. I love that case a lot. I shouldn't say I love it.
It's an interesting case. Yeah, yeah, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I have. That's actually really funny that I just did that because me and my co-host Shane, we talk a lot about how we can't say that anything in our particular field of podcasting is cool.
Yeah.
Unless it's obviously somebody getting caught. Yes, them getting caught is cool. But we're like, we have to say that everything is interesting. So our tagline for most of our podcasts has been, that's interesting. Yes, that's very interesting.
That's different.
Yeah.
So, Scott Thomas, any questions for him about this?
No, I'm going to be start listening. That's for sure.
It sounds awesome, and I will definitely be tuning in. I saw one of them that caught my attention was the Zodiac Killer, and I was wondering what your opinion on the Zodiac case is, and if you believe the guy who's pitching that his dad, Earl Van Best, is the Zodiac Killer because he looks like the composite sketch.
Yes. I will say real quick, Zodiac personally right now is my favorite episode. So if you're going to listen to one, please do listen to that one, because I absolutely loved making Zodiac. And you'll even notice that in most of our cross examinations for the podcast, I basically reference Zodiac as like the big turning point from where the podcast was very, I don't want to say like amateur to professional, but it feels almost a lot like that.
You have those moments.
Yeah, but as for the theory of Earl Van Best's dad, I don't put too much stock into it, only because all of the evidence that he gave was very circumstantial. And there's way more evidence for other people, such as Lawrence Kane and Arthur Lee Allen. My personal feelings on the case are that Arthur Lee Allen and Lawrence Kane were both the Zodiac, but at different times. And Lawrence Kane was almost like a copycat to Arthur Lee Allen. in that sense. But Earl Van Best Jr., from what I remember, the evidence for him was that the cipher for the My Name Is Cipher, his the amount of letters in his name matched the amount of letters in the cipher, as well as the composite sketch looks like him. But the composite sketch also kind of looks like Ted Cruz, too. So I don't know how much stock people put into that. I think it is a possibility, but I don't think it's more likely than any of the other theories out there.
Yeah, and his belief that he found his dad's name in the cipher, one guy came on and said, yeah, I can find my name in this cipher. I think you said that. You can find just about anybody's name you want to hidden in that cipher if you interpret it the way that that he did. You know,
yeah.
So it seems flimsy evidence to me too. I think ultimately the Zodiac might. The only way the Zodiac is ever going to be solved is occasionally now they're getting new DNA on file from people who get arrested later on in life, or something happens later on in life to get their DNA on file, and then that shows up in the system when they test the old DNA from the crime scenes. I think they found the Golden State Killer that way, like 50 years after. So. Maybe that'll happen, but it's a stretch.
Yeah. I know like the most recent stuff for the Zodiac case, at least as of right now, was back in 2020. They solved the hardest cipher that he gave besides the My Name Is cipher, which was like a 400 character cipher. And it was this team of a guy from Sweden and a guy from Asia and a guy from America. And they all were working like tirelessly. It took them like, I think they said about 20 years to crack it. And they just cracked it in December of 2020. And it was like revealing, and it was like a big, big crack in the case because it like almost showed that there is a there's much more of a possibility of a copycat killer than most may believe, which helps me because I was lobbying for that theory a little beforehand when I was writing the episode, because I wrote most of these episodes. I think I wrote all the way up until Zodiac about, I think, early 2020. And then that came out late 2020. So I was like, yes, I may have predicted something somewhat right.
Here's something like this is way down a rabbit hole, but I read something about a week ago where I'm amazed this hasn't been seized on by defense attorneys. They've done some studies now that found that people to get bone marrow transplants and some blood transplants, when they test their DNA, that person will have the DNA markers of themselves and the donor.
Oh, that's cool.
But at the same point in time, this throws a huge question mark into all the people who are sitting in jail only because of DNA evidence.
Yeah.
Well, it's definitely something to look into, and
definitely. So, yes,
but I definitely went on a rabbit hole.
Well, that's okay. It was a good sampling of what you can expect on the Cold Case Chase. So, we know how to reach you, Ruck, if we want to get in touch with you or check out the show. Scott, how could anybody comment with us?
You can reach us at www.itswaytooeasythisweek, and I'm not going to do it with the fake website, ravinglunaticmedia.com, ravinglunaticmedia.com, ravinglunaticmedia.com. Ragemaster, what's left for them to do?
Stay sick, sickies.
So what I told you was true. From
Sci-Fi Malady
point of view.